Welcome. I'm Gary Parr, and in just a couple of minutes, we'll enjoy our conversation with Eileen Bennett from the Sampler House. But first, I want to tell you about this week's sponsors. EGA, the Embroiderers Guild of America, is a community of stitch-minded people who inspire passion for the needle arts through education and the celebration of its heritage. Join today at egausa.org to become a member of the community, gain access to educational opportunities, projects, and more. Online classes, current ones that you need to take a look at, Geraniums by Marilyn Hazelwood. That registration ends November 4. And then Goldwork Bracelet with Cynthia Jackson. That registration ends December 2nd. Then you also want to look at, if you're a member, look at Lightning Rounds. And those are group correspondence courses that have been handpicked by the Education Department and made available for individual EGA members to register without a group for a limited time. Lightning Rounds are a great opportunity for members at large and small EGA chapters that have difficulty filling a larger group to take a correspondence course. It's also an excellent option for a small group of friends wanting to work on one of our courses, of the EGA courses, or chapter meetings wanting to explore a new technique. Current Lightning Round registration ends on December 1, and four new classes are available. How Does Your Garden Grow? Perfectly Counted Crosses, Mark and Paint on Canvas and Fabric, and Roses. And then, of course, don't forget the 2021 National Seminar, The Magnificent Stitch, in downtown Chicago. That'll be September 1 to September 5, hosted by the Great Lakes Region Chapter, and registration is underway now at egausa.org. Then when you put together and decide what kit you want and what class you're going to take, then you'll want to kit things up at Needle in a Haystack. And whether you are an experienced embroiderer seeking specialty threads, a needlework frame for a workshop, or are a beginner taking your first steps in selecting the right hoop and linen fabric for a project, you'll find Needle in a Haystack's curated collection of needlework materials and accessories comprehensive and inspiring. They are there, we are here to guide you in your selection of the most suitable materials to make you a success. Our expertise in a wide range of techniques and quality materials is designed to assist our customers to achieve a beautiful end result. Whether you're planning to stitch your next masterpiece with real metal threads or want to kit up a sampler project and use silk thread for the first time, we are here for you. It's our belief that needlework is a practical and rewarding luxury that is within the reach of everyone. We are proud to support this Fiber Talk show and hope it will give you a whole new perspective on the beautiful world of present-day embroidery, and invite you to visit our website at needlestack.com and take a look at our offerings. Also, a note that Needle in a Haystack ships worldwide. And I ask you to support our sponsors, EGA and Needle in a Haystack, and let them know that you heard about them from Fiber Talk. And now we'll listen to our conversation this week with Eileen Bennett of the Sampler House. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Eileen Bennett from the Sampler House. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. Yep. People on the, a couple weeks ago, the live show, Betty Howe had destashed her stash and sent us some charts to give away. And one of them was one of your designs. And
okay.
Caught my eye as I was showing it to the people. This is what we're giving away. And I had just pulled them out. Just, all right, I'm going to give away these four. And during the show, I'm describing what the design is, and I can't for the life of me remember what it is now. I thought, man, I really like this, and never heard of Eileen Bennett. And then your business card was in the bag because it was a kit.
Okay.
And then you're from Michigan, and I'm from Michigan, so that, all right, now we gotta connect with Eileen and do it. So I appreciate you doing the show. It's great.
Oh, I love it. I looked forward to it. I've known about it for a couple of days, and I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. We're going to talk about my very favorite subject, samplers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, we are. We are, yep.
I have to share this with you. Not always my friends and family know what I'm exactly about. but when they sort of learn about it, they say, oh, I think that's really nice you've got a hobby. I said, no, it's not a hobby. Well, it's nice you've got a passion. I said, don't mistake it. I'm consumed with it.
Yeah.
And yeah. Then I have to go ahead and explain a little bit. But it truly took over my life a number of years ago. And no matter what I know about samplers, is never enough. I'm always in research. I'm always studying. I'm always learning. I can't explain it to anyone. It's a passion that enters your life that you can't describe.
Yep. Well, I remember it's a few years ago now, Sampler Quarterly magazine.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I bought a couple of issues of that at the needlework store. Really, I knew antique samplers, reproduction samplers existed, but really didn't know a thing about them. And I bought the magazines. I thought, well, I'm going to learn. And then I looked at them, and oh, it's interesting, and went back to my needlepoint. And and it wasn't till I started doing Fiber Talk that I really came to appreciate what's behind reproduction samplers. And now own several charts and have three or four in the works on my
Wonderful.
Own.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I like to explain samplers. It's like the classical music to the world of needlework.
Mm.
This is where the learning took place.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's left over. We watched a stitcher perhaps begin a sampler, and by the time she got down to the bottom, her stitching improved greatly. Wasn't necessarily meant to be framed, quite often just rolled up and put away as an example.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's just it. Yeah, not a work of art, just a functional thing to learn. Yeah,
yeah, exactly right. It was a female education way back. It was limited what a woman could do to earn a living. Once in a while, if her husband died and he owned a business, she could take over the business. But to start a business as a woman, unheard of.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could be a nurse, you could be a teacher, but you couldn't be a teacher that was married.
Mm.
Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, these things happen. So it's a lot of social history as well as needlework history.
Well, how did you connect with samplers?
I hope I don't make this too long of a story.
We got all kinds of time.
Okay, Gary, I was living in Hawaii. And if you've lived in Hawaii on the island of Oahu, you quickly learn that the city of Honolulu, has over 1 million-plus people. And the island itself is the size of Kent County here in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Uh-huh.
There's two main highways. So at peak travel time, what should take 20, 25 minutes to get to a destination can take 2.5 hours.
Mm.
And the I think it was the YMCA in Honolulu, had a lot of classes that they would do. And they had classes that they called pau hana classes. Pau meaning end of, and hana meaning work. So end of work.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going out and fighting the traffic, come on in, take a class, then go home. You're going to get home about the same amount of time,
Yep.
And it was great. And there were so many classes. It was almost like a small catalog. Well, I've always wanted to learn how to do needlepoint or canvas work, as it's properly called. And they were offering a class, which I signed up for. Well, a lot of people signed up for it, and they only had one main teacher. So the overflow they gave to a woman who was mainly a potterer. Does this make sense?
Okay. I'm tracking with you, but it doesn't make a lick
All
of
right.
sense. No.
I got to go on. But she was a very smart teacher. There were about 11 or 12 of us in the class. Made a good friend there that was from Australia. She was a neat gal. She would assign each of us a class lesson to teach or a stitch to teach.
Mm.
So what we learned was charted needlepoint, charted canvas work.
Uh-huh.
Now, this was about 1972. That's how long ago.
Yeah.
Okay, so about the end of 1972, I come back to the Grand Rapids area. My husband had what they call rock fever. Get me off this island. I can't handle it anymore. And we came back to Grand Rapids, and two or three years later, counted cross stitch was introduced in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it and I thought, oh, I've learned how to do a half across. I can do this.
Yeah.
So I signed up for the class, made two of my friends to sign up with me. They never did need to work either, so it was okay. And the lady that was teaching the class was the woman that started our Embroiderers Guild here in Grand Rapids area.
Oh.
So she could see I was getting very enthused about this project, and she said, why don't you join our EGA group? So I did that fall. My other two friends could have cared less. In fact, a couple years later, I opened a needlework store with a friend, and one of the friends that had learned counted cross stitch with me comes in the store with their unfinished project, flops it on the counter, and said, I haven't even finished my project, and you got a needlework store. Well, the other thing that happened that probably opened my eyes, Gary, was I've been an antiquer for some time, and I used to see the antique samplers, and I used to marvel at them, but because I didn't stitch, I didn't really understand what they were about. And then I remembered they were done in a cross stitch.
Mm-hmm.
It was like this little flame got lit, and then this explosion happened. But there wasn't much written at the time on the subject of samplers. And anything I could get my hands on, I was reading. Any collection that I could see, I was going to see it, studying them. And I have to be honest with you, I love to look at the front side of a sampler for about 2 minutes, and then I want to see the back side.
Mm-hmm.
Because that tells me how it was stitched.
Yep.
And that's where the story is.
Yep. I agree with you 100%. I love looking at the back. You know, people, don't look at my back. No, I want to see how you go about it. Yep.
Yeah. And that's, well, with some of the old samplers, you're probably aware that I've written a number of books on the stitches of samplers.
Yes.
Okay. Many of them, well, Montenegrin stitch, for one, was only recorded in one book. And it was a DMC book. And that was towards the end of the 1800s. But it was an old stitch.
Mm-hmm.
And how to do some of these stitches, it just wasn't clear how they were done. So being at kindergarten level, I dissected these stitches, and that's what my stitch books are all about. It's about, you can do this too. If I can learn this, you can learn this.
Mm-hmm.
So I take it apart, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, so on.
So you just dove right into the giant...
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah, like I said, you know, this little flame was ignited with the potterer in my class in Hawaii. And then the explosion occurred when I got back to Michigan.
Yeah.
And, it was nuts. When I had my needlework store and I specialized in samplers, I had a little corner. And then during the month of February, I guess because it was George Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday, I sort of called it Patriotic Month. And nothing was more patriotic to me than a small girl sampler.
Mm-hmm.
So a few of my friends, we live in a Dutch area, as you probably know, Grand Rapids. So Dutch samplers were, I don't want to say in excess, but there were a few around. And I would encourage the people that stitch the samplers to bring in their models. So all over the walls are these samplers during the month of February. I think one of the funniest things that happened, a mom comes in one day, and he's about 4, a very well-behaved little guy, kind of with his hands behind his back, as you would expect a little museum goer to do.
Yeah.
And he's looking at all these samplers, and he's just taking everything in, and mom's now up at the counter paying for a purchase, and I've got samplers behind me, and he says, wow, Mom, somebody doesn't know their alphabet. I lost it. I knew I couldn't explain to him, make it clear enough at that age so that he would understand, so I just left it.
Just let it ride, yep.
Yeah, it was great.
That's interesting now. Of course, growing up in Michigan myself, Dutch samplers, but then you've done quite a bit of exploration of samplers that are in Michigan.
I have. In fact, I started on, I guess I self-appointed
Michigan,
myself.
Michigan probably not on the top 10 list of sampler resources.
That's exactly right, which led me into another project, which I'll go into too. But I sort of appointed myself as a sampler survey person. Back in 1976, the Quilters Guild did a quilt survey of Michigan-made quilts. I'm trying to think of Sue's last name. I know it as well as I know my own. Sue Studebaker, who wrote two books on Ohio samplers, was a friend of mine. She has since passed, and that was such a loss. But she had done two beautiful books, and she was encouraging me, "What have you done with the Michigan?" And I said, "Nothing." She said, "Well, get going. Get at it." Well, Ohio had a richer history than what Michigan did.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept hitting roadblocks. Now, we uncovered a few, not tremendous amount, but because many of the, well, I have to go back. Michigan started to be settled about 1833 outside of the Detroit area. So that's a little late for sampler making, really.
Mm-hmm.
And those that were coming into Michigan were coming in from New York and Connecticut.
Yeah.
And they were bringing New York and Connecticut styles with them.
Mm-hmm.
So unless it said Michigan, unless you knew who the family was, where they were, where the kids went to school, could you identify a Michigan sampler? Was there an identifying mark that said, oh, this was made in Michigan?
Yeah.
Yeah. It created so many problems, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
So I hit a roadblock. I've been doing genealogy for 40 plus years. So I said to myself, well, what do I know about my own county, Kent County, Grand Rapids, Michigan? Well, simple things I learned in school. Well, when did the people start coming into the area? I didn't know. Well, you better find out. So I went back to the history books, and I think there were five. And out of those five, I was able to pull out 35 pioneer teacher names.
Mm.
And that took me from about, well, the first one came in 1834, and that's a story by itself, through the Civil War. And I thought, they're more than a name. They had lives. They had families. I need to find out about them. Well, make a long story short, there are four books that I wrote on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I called it boarding around because that's exactly what they did. They would be in areas, and of course, transportation was limited, so they would actually stay with the families in the school area where they were teaching, the one-room schools. And that could be interesting because
yeah.
Sometimes they'd have to sleep with their students.
Yeah.
I remember one story, one woman, she had this one-room schoolhouse, and she had a loft, a tiny little loft up above one corner of it. And she had a ladder that went up to it, and she made an area where she could sleep. And then the stove that kept the schoolroom warm is where she prepared her meals.
Uh-huh.
She had had enough of boarding around, so she was down there. So anyway, I thought, well, if I can pick out what they were teaching, maybe that would give me an insight. But it didn't. It just led me on to another project. So I finished up Kent County and then went on to Ionia County because the early people who came, part of them stayed there,
mm-hmm.
which is the county next to us. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I had over 700 names of these early pioneer teachers. And I've been doing the genealogy on all of them that I can. So that takes me out of the needlework field, still in the research and still with teachers. But I'm not finding the Michigan information I was looking for.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that creates a problem. Of course, we're talking, I don't want to call it public education because it really wasn't public education.
Yeah.
You had to pay, you know, there were so many in a village, you had to pay so much to send your kids to school, and then you had to provide firewood to keep the kids warm
and
on and on and on, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So there were subscription schools, but trying to find them is almost impossible without going through newspapers. day by day by day.
Oh, really? Oh, even today with the Google and everything else, still difficult.
Yes. Huh? Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. People didn't pay attention to it, so it wasn't really recorded and kept as a quick reference. So you're constantly digging.
Yeah.
I feel like I got calluses on my hands from this shovel in my hands all the time.
So where do you encounter the Dutch samplers? Do you just trip over them at some point?
Yeah. One of my friends had a family piece that was most interesting over in Holland, Michigan, which is about 25 minutes from me, 25 miles, is a Dutch museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are a few in there, last I knew. But they're interesting. Martin X, are you familiar with that name?
No.
Okay, Martin X has an antique shop that specializes in Dutch samplers in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And you got to tap into Martin X.
Okay.
He's a neat gentleman.
All right.
And you'll see a lot of Dutch samplers there. They're unique.
Yeah, I was going to say, how compare those to British, European samplers, different color palettes, different motifs?
Different motifs. A lot of them, because they still wore their ethnic costumes, a lot of the band designs would be used on headband pieces or hem areas of skirts, mm-hmm. things like that. A lot of things that pertain to the Netherlands, of course, being on the sea, you'd see ships,
uh-huh.
things like that. They're heavily, the fabric is usually heavily embroidered. The Dutch are very thrifty people. You wouldn't want to waste any linen, so you'd want to use all of that fabric.
So no blank canvas, huh?
no blank canvas. They also had a unique alphabet. The uppercase is very unique, but if you carefully look at the lowercase alphabets, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to let you explore this for yourself.
Okay.
There's an unusual letter, and every time I see that letter, I can say Dutch or Dutch influenced.
You can tell that's your key, huh?
Yep.
Now, are there a lot of them in Michigan, or just the smattering that a museum might have?
Oh, that's a good question. I think our Grand Rapids Museum has maybe one or two.
Okay.
And last I looked, they had 52 samplers here in Grand Rapids. Of course, you know, when you say samplers in museum, people think, oh, I'm going to go to the museum and I'm going to see them.
Yeah.
Textile, about 10% of a collection, the entire collection of a museum, is out and on exhibit. The 90% is back in the archives.
Yeah.
So you have to make appointments to get to see them. And they can be hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure they're reluctant for a lot of reasons. Yeah.
Well, sometimes it's just the lack of staff, mm-hmm. because they don't like to leave you alone with the pieces, which I understand.
Right.
So that means they have to have a person that sits with you.
Mm. And there's the hours right there. Yep.
Yep. Yep. So a lot of things happen. So when you request, you know, a visit into the archives, understand these things. Be patient with the people. Be gracious. Be thankful. Don't take anything for granted, because you don't know how much of their work they had to set aside to be with you.
Yeah. Just sitting there answering.
Just sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah. Answering the idle question or the occasional question, yeah. Yeah.
And usually if you've been into samplers long enough, you start answering questions and they look at you and they say, I think you know more than I do.
I'm just going to sit here and read my book while you look.
Right. So I'm going, oh, okay.
What's that experience like for you to go, you know, let's just stay with Dutch samplers, to go in there and be able to see the collection? Do you start laying them out side by each and comparing and contrasting? What goes through your mind when you study those?
Well, usually you're not allowed to touch them.
Oh, okay.
That's usual. There are exceptions, and there was one huge one I'll tell you about. Usually you tell them what you want to see. And if you're not specific, then they bring out what they think is interesting or what they can easily get at.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll bring them out and they'll be set on a table and you're able to look at them. And then if I want to look at the back side, I'll have to say to them, could you turn it over for me?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I've got my 7-power magnifying glasses on and my other 7-power in my hand, and I'm going over that thread by thread.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and they're just sitting there and they're going, oh God, I wish you'd get out of here. And I'm totally mesmerized.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, yeah, you're camped for the day. You're good.
Yeah, yeah. Making notes and all kinds of things. Yeah. It's a crazy world. No. Let me rephrase that. I'm probably crazy.
Well, whatever works.
Whatever works.
Do you start, when you look at them, though, I assume you start to see patterns, start to be able to know a teacher, pick up on those things?
Sometimes. Not always.
Not always. Okay.
Yeah.
The old it depends routine.
Yeah. And sometimes you can just totally be mistaken. You say, oh, I know what this is. And then you go back to the records and see what's written down. You go, oh, well, I missed that one. But keep in mind, say a girl goes to a finishing school and she's learning this and she's learning the techniques and she wants to earn a little bit of a living. She discovers she can get paid for teaching. So she's going to teach what she's learned. Mm-hmm. So it's the same techniques that are being handed down, but not by the primary person that began with this technique or this motif or this style.
Yeah. Is it the history or the needlework that intrigues you the most?
Oh, boy. That's a hard one to choose. I think being a researcher, I'd probably have to say the history first. Yeah. It was just like my notebook of sampler stitches. It's the very first time that the history of the stitches, as I could find it and as I knew it, came together with the diagrams. Very first time.
Mm-hmm.
Some stitches, they're called different things in different countries. I'm in Ireland, and I'm working with Heather Crawford, and I'm working at the Ulster Folk Museum. And she keeps referring to the Rococo stitch. And I said, oh, Heather, I said, in America, we call the Rococo stitch a queen stitch.
Mm.
She said, oh, Eileen, she said, if we called it a queen stitch here, we'd be so confused. She said, what you call a queen stitch, we call a four-sided stitch here in Ireland.
Okay.
So that was kind of a funny little story, but she wrote the only book that's been written on Northern Irish samplers, and then she used some of my stitch diagrams in the back of the book. So that was fun.
So the stitch names are no different than common names for animals and plants.
It depends on the region of the area that you're at. Another good one is Bargello flame stitch. Irish stitch. It was called Irish stitch because the Irish nuns did a lot of it.
Oh, okay. For no other reason than that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I know the names of stitches, as I can research them, say I put a four-sided stitch in my notebook of sampler stitches, I'll give you all the alternative names too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if there's a confusion in your mind, and then in the back, I have it all indexed so you can refer to whichever.
Yeah. Well, that's fun. That's fun too, because I often think, well, really, with any needlework, that it would be fun. I can always just envision a giant map that shows how the techniques moved throughout the world and throughout time.
Yeah.
You know, the same. It's basically the same techniques.
You also have to go back to textiles.
Yes.
Textiles that were being imported, say, from India and so forth into England. The style or the coloration of the period influenced the needlework of the period.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at this as well. You can't just be, what do I want to say, single focused.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to almost know the history of the era, the history of the place, to understand the needlework of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, where it came from. Yeah.
Yep. What influenced it? What was going on at the time? Were there wars? Were people coming in because they were driven out of their country?
Mm-hmm.
Just various things were happening and brought their techniques with them. You hear the term Black Irish. These mm-hmm. were the black-haired Spaniards that were exiled from Spain coming into Ireland and stayed. And, of course, brought their techniques with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where samplers, but needlework in general, historic needlework in general, it almost gives you a book in its own right of history.
Yeah, it does.
If you can do the research to follow it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. If you can, say, follow one area, one small area, one small teacher, and maybe their teaching years were only 3 or 4, maybe less than 10 years. They had a lot of students.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow it that way, but how often does that happen?
Right, right, yeah. Well, now, you did a lot of your research before we had the internet.
Yes.
So that's hard work.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I can't tell you. Like I said, when I started out, I took that class in 1975, County Cross Stitch, and then joined the Embroiderers Guild in Grand Rapids here that fall. I'm trying to think how many books, history books, I could put my finger on. Maybe one, maybe two that I could put my finger on that was written on the history of samplers.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, of course, when the internet came in and it opened it up, you could now search for a book online. You may find it in England. You may find it on the West Coast. But you can get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe a library. It shows up. It's at a particular library, and you can read it online. So those things happen.
Yeah. Opens some doors for you. Yep.
Yeah. But I won't tell you what my library looks like because you probably wouldn't believe it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it's massive.
I have more needlework books than most libraries have.
I'm sure of that, yeah. Well, and I got to believe, before the internet, you find a book like that, you grab it.
Oh, gosh, yes. I think the most I paid for a book, and I don't even know if I want to tell people this. I know one did. I bought an exhibit book that was written by Betty Ring before she came out with her 2-volume set, and I paid $19.95 for it. Last I saw it listed on the internet, it was going for $650. So those are, treasures. The most I've paid is $350, but it was a book I knew I would never see again.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
grab
what's going to happen?
Grab it and keep it from going to the trash somewhere. Yep.
Exactly right. So what is going to happen to my library someday? I said to my daughter, I said, if you don't have an interest in it, I said, find a needlework book dealer before you just put it in a garage sale.
Yep. Well, that's the thing, today's libraries. They're just shedding books because they want space for computers. And, how many of those books that, how many, one-off instances in libraries all over the world, certainly in this country, have thrown away books that will never be seen again? You just really have to wonder.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a number of them that you open up the cover and it says withdrawn, and then it gives the library name.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm going, you got rid of this? Why?
Yeah.
Unless they had 10 copies. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. But no, that's to me is the real crime. But you understand, where are they going to put all these books that nobody's checking out anymore? Yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And the space is getting limited, for libraries.
Right.
Well, we just put a new library in our township here. And it was fought probably for 3 or 4 elections in a row before people finally saw the need for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening all over the country. People are hurting. They don't have jobs right now.
Right.
They're going to vote to have more taxes. I don't think
no,
so.
Probably not. No. Yeah. Well, and the function of the library has changed in the last 7, 8, 10 years dramatically in terms of the services they provide.
That's true.
It's not just a house for books anymore. There's so much more to it. And books just get shoved to the corner because of that.
Yeah, except they do provide, you know, the meeting room. I see one-on-one instructors working with students.
Right.
Probably, I think a lot of them are being educated in English. I know my high school that I graduated from, which was predominantly white when I was there. Now it has, because I belong to an alumni group, I know this. There are 14 ethnic groups that are in the school district today.
Yep.
And it was a blue-collar area when I was in high school. In our alumni group, all we do, that's our whole purpose, is we furnish scholarships for these kids. And a number of them are homeless. They come in on buses in the morning from inner city. I have to share this with you because I'm so proud of it. This is something any group can do if you are really interested in it. We gave out 43 $4,000 scholarships each, plus 25 $2,000 scholarships each for kids that were in school already in college.
Wow.
43.
Wow.
Yeah. And we didn't say you had to have a certain grade point average. All you had to have was a desire to go to school. And you write a little essay and you tell us why, and we'll see that you get there.
That's fantastic. Wow.
Yeah. So nothing to do with needlework, but, no, but it is education.
That's right. That's right. So what is your, do you have a collection of originals?
I do. Not a huge collection, Gary. And people are usually surprised or amazed when I say that. I have probably less than 12. My oldest one is English piece. It's $17.99. And I did reproduce it. It's a Betsy Patrick sampler. Because I work with them in museums and see collections all the time, I guess I don't feel that need to own them.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that doesn't surprise me that you don't have a lot of them for that very reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know where they are. You know they're safe in some museum somewhere. And
And when you hang them in your house, you really have to be careful where you put them. You don't want them on an outside wall where moisture can get into the back. You don't want them into direct sunlight or lamp light. So you're kind of limited where you can hang them safely.
Yeah.
So that puts a damper on things too.
Right. And owning them and having them in a drawer, that's not much
fun.
Yeah,
it's not the same thing. You know, you want to enjoy them. You know, your own needlework, you usually put it in a frame.
Yep.
Although I gotta confess here, maybe I shouldn't. Oh, I will anyway. I think I've designed, it's over 100. And I can count probably 5 or 6 that hang in my house.
The rest,
I've stored them away. Well, I used to do trade shows and, you know, you were always transporting them. They got stored in storage trunks.
Yep.
And that's where they are today.
Yep.
That's terrible to say, isn't it?
It'll be the kids' problem someday. Yeah.
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 I think you could read my mind on that one.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So I'm not going to worry about this.
When it comes, because you've reproduced and then you've also done originals.
Yes.
Did the originals, is that what kind of gets your heart racing because of the creativity there? Do you borrow a lot from reproductions or from antiques to make your originals? How do you go about that?
All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah. The antique ones inspire me incredibly. I've got, notebook after notebook after notebook of drawings that I've made at various museums and so on. They do inspire me. I particularly enjoy the 17th century band samplers, probably because of the variety of stitches and stitch techniques that were on them. They hold a fascination for me I can't quite describe, and a lot of my reproduction, or not reproduction, but newly created pieces are in a band sampler format.
Yeah, I noticed that. A lot of that, yes.
Yeah. So that has influenced me greatly. And of course, then we get into the other techniques of reticella in laces, which is spelled L-A-C-I-S, which is a weaving technique. Just a tremendous amount of things occur on those pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So the interest is there.
So you migrate to the pieces that offer more than just simple cross stitch.
Yes. In fact, I've done very few that are just cross stitch.
Mm-hmm.
Very few. I don't want to say I'm bored with it, but.
Well, they all have their place.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. They do. And some very important museum pieces, 19th century pieces, mainly are just cross stitch, and they're still very appealing. I love them.
Yeah. Because you talk about in your designs, designs that are challenging and then others that are, what did you say? Comforting or relaxing or something like that.
Intentional
on your part in your designs to create one over the other?
Well, I'll let you in on a little secret, Gary, and it's what I tell my students. I only use stitches that I love to use.
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't find a teaching piece fun to do, it's not going to be fun for my students to do either.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my concept. If it's not fun, I'm not going to do it. But maybe that's my philosophy in life. But those that know me from my teaching know that I come from an Irish family. And I always have to say, yes, it's true. We're about 10 feet off center. And nothing can bring us back. We're just dippy people. But we have fun. And if it's not fun, I'm not going to do it, Gary.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah, but you enjoy putting in the different stitches and.
Yeah, I'm probably one of the very, very few teachers that teach the Holly Point stitch. It's it's a complex stitch. It takes me 3 pages probably to explain it and diagram it. And it takes me 30 seconds to show it to you.
Okay.
But you have to get your thumb involved. It's a real challenge when I get a left-hander in my class. It's the only stitch I can't do left-handed.
Mm.
And they have to do different things. Some stand behind me. Some have to sit in front of me to duplicate it. I happened to teach that stitch for an online EGA class about a year ago. And I had, I think, 107 students. Maybe it was more than that. And I went, oh, boy, I've got this Holly Point stitch to do. What am I going to do? So I called my tech-savvy granddaughter, as probably the rest of people who have grandchildren. Our kids learn keyboarding in preschool.
Right.
This was our typing classes in high school. So they're just way above us. So I said, Erin, I've got to demonstrate this class. Can we make a small video so I can show it to the ladies, because I was getting all these comments, I can't do this stitch. And I kept saying, give me 30 seconds and I'll show you how easy it is. So that's exactly what she illustrated with the video, is me doing the stitch.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't have anyone that said they couldn't do it.
Yeah, there you go. Works.
Yeah.
Well, I have to look up the Holly Point stitch. I don't know that one.
Well, you can even get a hold of me, Gary. I can give you an online class.
Okay. Okay.
We can do a one-on-one here.
Okay.
You'd be amazed sometimes how many phone calls I get or emails from people, and it is a one-on-one class.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it's a good resource if you're willing to do it. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, you know, I nothing gives me greater pleasure. And I'll have to go back on the story. Let me go back on the story first, and then I'll tell you. I walked into a classroom one day, and the girl was sitting in the front row, and she was crying. I felt terrible. I didn't know quite what to say. I didn't know if I should invade her private space. And I finally got the courage to go over to her, and I said, did something sad and bad happen? She said, no. She said, I just don't think I can do this class. And the tears were running down her cheek.
Oh, my.
And I said, will you just stay with me? Will you give me a chance? And she said she would. And there she is in front row, so I can't let her down.
Right.
And she can't escape out the back door.
Right.
By the end of the class, there was a smile on her face, and she said, yes, I can.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
Yeah.
That's teaching right there.
Well, it probably started back with my needlework store that I had. That's another story. But anyway, linen was just coming. Remember, 2 years after I had the class, now I have a needlework store.
Right.
And everything was done. Some people call it Ada cloth, but at that time we were calling it Aida cloth.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And hardanger cloth, not hardunger. Hardanger.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and that was back in the day when there were cross-stitch shops everywhere. They were gas stations, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, from that Aida and the hardanger and all that, there was a book that came out. It was called Opera Stitch. Do you remember that?
No, Opera Stitch?
Opera Stitch. It was just decorative stitches on Aida cloth. But they took the Aida name, which was, classical music.
Right.
That's what it come from. Anyway.
Okay.
Okay, so linen is coming in, and I'm trying to encourage people to get into linen because this is what the samplers were all about. So I would custom cut linen for my customers, and I often had little pieces left over. So I took a little wicker basket, and I took those pieces, and I took needle and thread, and I would do one cross stitch on this piece of linen, then I'd put the needle with the thread back in the fabric and set by my cash register. And I put a sign on that says, try me.
Oh.
So they'd come up to the register, and they would make a comment, and I said, well, give it a try. Just duplicate what I've done on the linen for you. And they'd pick it up, and they'd do it, and they'd say, I can do this. I said, yes, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And we converted them. But you have to show them that they can do this.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Yeah, that was my, I remember my first, the only cross-stitch class I ever took was back, I still have the sampler. It was a sweetheart tree or whatever.
And, sure.
And,
well, she lived in, she lived in the Chicago area at that time.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Okay.
But of course, I was the only male in the class, but it was a class on stitching on linen.
Okay.
Like it was, like some insurmountable thing to do. So I went, and I, of course, way out of place. They all looked at me like I was weird. But,
I've had a number of men in classes, Gary, so don't feel badly about that.
But it was, the first class, what's the big deal here? It's just a grid. I've always struggled with that because it's just a grid. I mean, some people struggle with it, and I don't know.
I can explain that to you. A man has an innate ability for architecture. And that's exactly what you were doing. You were building a stitch on a grid.
Hmm.
And a woman doesn't often see it through that eye.
Oh, so it's me that's the problem.
It's
okay.
It's a man thing.
Okay.
And a lot of the men in Europe, particularly the Norwegian countries, they did a lot of stitching.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the sailors, they had a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
Some beautiful needlework has come out from men stitching.
Well, that's good to know that it's just me. Okay, fine.
No. I've had a lot of men in my classes over the years.
Yeah. Well, it was a big deal. Learn to stitch on linen. And so what is this, whatever.
You're going, what's a big deal?
Yeah. Why am I here? Yeah.
I love it.
But I did finish it. I finished it and had it framed and still have it today. So.
Yeah, you enjoyed it. That was the main thing.
Yeah. Yep. Because my experience had been on Aida or Aida cloth. That's funny.
It depends on which area of the country you came from, how they pronounced it. I still pronounce it Aida, and people look at me. And I said, well, that's what it was called when I was buying it by 15 and 20 yard bolts.
Yep. Yep.
So I don't know.
You just stick with it. Yep.
Yeah.
You've done a bunch of books, a whole bunch of books.
I have.
The one that intrigued me of the list that I was able to find was the Monogram album.
Oh, that's a beautiful book, Gary. I own the original, and it was probably printed in the late 1800s. And I had kept it for years. It was on one of my bookshelves, and I would get it out and look at it from time to time. And finally, one day I said, this is stupid. I should be sharing this book with others.
Mm-hmm.
So I can still remember it was winter months, and you know, you don't get out too much during the winter months in Michigan necessarily.
Yeah.
So I started in, each page had its own letter and all variations of a letter. So I started in, and it would take me probably 4 or 5 hours to reproduce that one page. So I did all of that, and I put it into a book form. I've also got a class that lets you design your own piece with decorative stitches using your initial page.
Uh-huh.
And that's a fun, but it's a beautiful book. If you need a resource on alphabets, there's none like it out there.
Now, is it all cross-stitch or embroidery, or how did you...
I just charted it so you can do whatever you want with it.
Okay.
That's what I teach in my class, is how to apply the various stitches to various areas.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly it can just be a cross stitch.
Yeah.
And okay. Still be beautiful.
But it's the shapes that you've preserved.
Yes.
Okay. Because that one, yeah, of all of them, well, that one and the pulled thread stitches were the two that... my initial reaction was I got to get my hands on those, but that monogram, that monogram one just kind of stuck out for me because it looked like it was one of those that you'd have sitting around and just pull out at any number of times because it would
for various projects, even if you just want to give a gift and do one of these beautiful monograms and cross stitch it for someone, put it into a frame. It's just a great gift.
Yeah.
Or on the front of a bag or, whatever.
Right. Right, yeah, that kind of thing. And then the pulled thread stitches, that a collection of stitches and how to do them?
It is. There are, I think, 82 or 83 stitches in the book. In fact, I have a class that I use the entire book and every stitch in the book. I just completed an online class with the Bay Area Sampler Guild. In fact, I concluded the class. It was 7 weeks long last week. And it was every stitch is used in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting technique. I love anything that's counted. So not only do you have, pulled thread. There's one book that you didn't mention to me, and it was my newest book. It's called Darn Beautiful. And it's a collection of weaving designs that I've translated into cross stitch and also into pattern darning.
Oh.
And then I even put a project in the back of the book.
Hmm.
And that is very restful to do, the pattern darning. If you've not done it, take a look at it.
Okay. No, haven't done that one. All right. I'll have to check that out. Yep.
Yeah. And then black work, of course, is in that same group. And hardanger. I do hardanger. I don't teach it, but I do work it.
Yeah, I enjoy that. I think that's, I don't know, something about white on white that I just enjoy in general. But
it's elegant.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely elegant.
Yeah. When you get some of those, Blancamp is one where, just bring out all the texture and
uh-huh.
it's just white on white. And to me, it's just beautiful to look at. And
you almost sound like you should be a photographer, Gary.
Well, I am.
Texture. Okay, because that's what a photographer goes yep. for is the texture.
No, I am. I am a photographer. I don't do enough of it these days, but I appreciate that. It's the I was taught when it came to photography is if the way to learn it is to shoot black and white. Because
yes.
because then you'll know light and contrast and texture and all the things, and then color covers up so many mistakes.
And, oh, yep. you got it. Yeah. Yep. And of course, when you're doing the decorative stitches, the lighter the thread you use, the better you can see the stitches.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing queen stitches, don't do them in a dark blue or dark red or whatever. Keep the thread color a little bit lighter, and you'll see the beauty of the stitch.
Yeah. That's one where that can get muddied up in a hurry, the queen stitch, where it just loses all of its definition. And I've seen that more than once, yeah.
Okay. Yep. That's one of my – in fact, I'm working on a piece right now. It's entirely done in queen stitches.
Oh, really?
Yeah, nothing else.
Oh, that'll take a minute to do.
It was a chart that I was able to put my hands on that was done in, I think, if I can recall now, 1699. And it was charted, but to my knowledge, it was never stitched. So I'm recreating it, and it's all done in queens.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you want a little bit of a challenge, I'll guarantee you when you finish it, you'll be the queen of the queen stitchers.
Okay.
You're on, Gary. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's tempting. I like a good challenge, so that's all right. So these days, you're writing more books, doing designs. What?
You know, I'm always designing because I'm always doodling. Okay. I also got into Zentangle, which is an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And black work is similar to Zentangle.
Okay.
So you might want to look into that. And, of course, my genealogy research, that's ongoing. I've done my family, and I did, Jane Bostock. In fact, England's still angry with me because I gave them the rest of the story. But it took me 9 months to do it.
Okay, I don't know Jane Bostock from...
Jane Bostock? Okay, let me tell you about Jane Bostock. She's England's oldest sampler, 1599 or 98. Okay. And she was done by Jane Bostock, and she worked it for little... the name's going right through my head right now. Alice Lee. And I was on a tour bus with a bunch of girls from England. We were out at sampler gathering. I was teaching. I had the day off, and we were, I don't know, some excursion. And I turned to Linda, and who's the head of the sampler guild, and I said, Linda, has anything been found more about Jane Bostock? It was found in an attic in 1960. It was found north of England, and they had the sampler. They could tell you all about the sampler, but they didn't know anything more about it. She said, yes, as a matter of fact, in a publication that was called Country Life, something like that, she said nothing to do with needlework, a woman claims she knows who the Bostock family was and gave clues to it. She said, when I get home, I'll make a copy of the article and I'll send it to you. She did, and, well, I was intrigued, and now I had to kick into my genealogy. So I started in, and I can see it was not going to be a simple task. But along the way, and because I'm using the Internet, I connected with a man by the name of, I'm not sure his last name was Lee, Alan something. I've got too many names in my head at the moment. But Alan, anyway, I connected with, he would come to the United States, and he would lecture on the Lee family of Virginia. So when I first contacted him and I told him I was researching this Jane Bostock sampler with this Alice Lee name on it, he thought I was a family member trying to tie my family into the Lees of Virginia, which everyone wants to do. And he said, yes, he said, I can help, but I charge £150 an hour. And I took a big gulp, and I wrote back, and I said, Alan, I'm not a family member. I'm researching a piece of needlework, and I'm trying to find the origins of it.
Calm down.
Yes. Well, he was most gracious. In fact, he went to the Lee house that's there, and I have a picture of the uncle that he sent me. It was a painting. He sent me a picture of the painting. Mm-hmm. And that's included in the book. And I was able to pull up the genealogy of Jane Bostock. And England's still angry about that. That's okay. I'm sorry.
Is Jane was all right, huh?
Yeah, she was fine.
Okay.
she come from royalty, and the sampler reflects not an ordinary life. Her uncle, Alice Lee, was the daughter of her uncle, and he was the sheriff of the county, and that was a prestigious position to hold.
Hmm.
Jane Bostock's, I think she was the fifth daughter, and her father had died young, so mom was kind of dependent upon her brother to support them, and I believe that Jane was probably working in the household of the Lee family, probably babysitting little Alice Lee, and she commemorated the sampler.
Oh, okay.
You can go to England and you can see it. It's at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, but it's in the archives.
Okay.
It used to be in the study room, and they've changed things. But I couldn't get to the back side of it, so I can't prove it. But just by looking at it, the bottom portion of it is very sophisticated. Numerous stitches, numerous techniques. And then you look at the top part of it with these scattered motifs, and these scattered motifs all point to the heraldry of the family.
Uh-huh.
And I went back and proved all of this as well. But it's done in a simple cross stitch. And I'm thinking there was fabric that was left, and someone added this. It wasn't Jane Bostock, but I can't prove it because I can't get to the back of it.
Uh-huh.
And stitchery, it's like needle or like handwriting. The backside, I can tell you if two or more people have worked on a piece by the way it's stitched.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I could have told immediately. I could have said, no, Jane Bostock did not work this top portion. It was done later by another descendant.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's fun. I love to look at the back of things of stitching because I feel like I learn a lot.
Well, that's where the story is. You can tell how it was constructed. See, that's where that architecture with men come in.
Yeah.
You're looking at how it was built,
mm-hmm.
if I could use that term. Yeah, it was built.
Yep. Yeah, no, but, I don't want to look at it to embarrass anyone. I just want to look at it to see
how was that?
Yeah. How do you go about it? How do you transfer from one to the next? If you're doing an alphabet, do you stop with each letter? How, you know, and where have you found ways to not end off and still not be seen from the front? You know, all those little things. I think it's interesting to learn that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And what looks like one stitch on the front, and when I turn it over on the back, I know we've created another stitch.
Uh-huh.
And that happens too. I think my biggest surprise one day, I'm at a trade show and a young gal comes in. I think she was a shopkeeper. I can't offhand remember where she was from or anything. She could have been like a visitor with a shopkeeper. But she had a German sampler and she was anxious for me to see it. And the Germans, instead of the long band samplers that the English are known for, the Germans go horizontally.
Hmm.
So it's wider than it is long.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be two or three columns in its width. Okay.
Okay.
So she brings it to me and it's a beautiful, beautifully worked sampler. And I'm looking at the front of it and then I had her turn it over to the back and it was totally reversible. What you see in the front and what you saw in the back was the same. And let me tell you, that's a technique.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, that's I've got one that's I'm doing reversibly, and it's been put away for a while. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You got to be totally concentrated on it.
Yeah.
What stitch are you using? Marking stitch?
Well, this is the Queen sampler, the Linda Vinson design from I can't remember her name, but the one that really drained me was the Montenegrin stitch. And, I got it, but it sapped the enthusiasm. Then other things came to play and I haven't gone back, but it's one I will finish because it's so beautiful that I want it.
Okay.
You know, I want it finished and I want to have it, but, stitching it reversibly and yeah, you really have to pay attention.
Yeah, you do. well, there are three marking stitches. One will give you a cross stitch on the front. and four-sided stitch on the back.
Yep.
One will give you a four-sided stitch on the front and a cross stitch on the back. And then the other marking stitch is a cross stitch on the front and a cross stitch on the back.
Yep. Well, that was the first that's the first alphabet in this sampler. Is that? Yes.
Okay.
And I chose the one that gives you the box on the back, the squares on the back. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Because
it was.
You still have to pay attention with every stroke.
Oh, I can't tell you how many times I flipped that thing over and I'd made a cross on the back. It's like, oh, come on. It just.
How did I do this?
Yeah. Pay attention. Yeah.
No.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, no, it'll get done someday, and I'll be proud of it. But
those marking stitches were used for a purpose. If you had, like, towels that you were going to use, something that would be seen on the front and the back side, like a cuff of a garment,
mm-hmm.
That's where the marking stitches would be used. So it would be perfect on the front and perfect on the back.
Yeah. And then hiding where you end off. Yeah. All those things. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, hiding off black work is a...
Oh.
Is a trick.
Yeah, see, I've never done black work, and the really good stuff fascinates me, because what people do with just thickness of thread and density, and and then to do it and you can't tell where they start or end is just, impressive.
It's awesome. It really is. There's a misconception out there, and of course I know this because I've been to Europe many times and studied various collections. It's a misnomer. They feel that all black work is reversible. Well, it is if it was used on a garment where both sides would be seen. Mm-hmm. Again, like a cuff area or a neck area. But if it was being used for a household product where it was going to receive a lot of wear, a back stitch would be used because it's a stronger stitch. So it doesn't have to be reversible unless you want it to be. But then if you're going to put it in a frame, you're not going to see both sides of it. Does it really matter?
Nope.
No. Okay.
Yeah, and it, the day I attempt black work, I will not do it reversibly. I guarantee you. No.
Just gonna... Oh, Gary.
No. I just want to get the front right.
I teach a class in reversible black work. You can't tell me that.
Oh, well, maybe someday. I just would want to get the front right and have it look good.
So. I might have to give you one-on-one classes right online here.
Okay. All right. Well, we could do that. Eileen, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Gary.
And thanks to everybody for listening.